Well, now we meet the cook whose rural Maine restaurant has made Time magazine's list as one of the world's greatest places. Erin French is the owner of The Lost Kitchen in her small hometown of Freedom. The population there hovers just above 700. The restaurant's located in a former 19th century grist mill in a picturesque setting, and foodies the world over clamour to dine there. Well, at least in better times than this. There's an eclectic booking system, which is always oversubscribed. More on that soon. Erin French absorbed her culinary skills working at her family's diner. She's never had any formal chef training. In fact, cooking for people in her hometown wasn't part of the grand plan. As explained in her memoir, Finding Freedom in the Lost Kitchen, there were many twists and turns, sadness and disappointments, which led her home, including an unplanned pregnancy, which derailed her medical studies in Boston, a nasty divorce, and some time in rehab. She says returning to a simple life in Freedom, Maine, has been healing and has led to personal and professional fulfilment, creating a memorable dining experience for people who managed to secure a reservation at The Lost Kitchen. Hello, Erin. Welcome to 9 to Noon. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Now, you need to explain two things. First, how is it that people manage to get a place at this very special restaurant?
It's kind of a different system. We accept reservations by postcard, and we run it more like a lottery style. And that's because years ago, we just started to get inundated with just requests, and it was crashing our phone lines, and we couldn't keep up with the space on our answering machine. And we just wanted to slow things down. So if anything, instead of going fast and going to the internet, I was just going to book it out anyway. We thought, well, what's the slowest possible way that we could handle this and make it as fair as possible? And we thought there's nothing slower than snail mail. So let's slow it down.
It's a delightful concept, and it's part of where your life had got to, right? You know, you hadn't got to this kind of peace to then end up running a sort of globally mad restaurant. This was part of the philosophy of life now, yeah?
Yeah, it was organically becoming that, I think, as I had tried for so long to keep up and be faster and be stronger, and it wasn't necessarily working out. And when I started to let go and find the things that brought me joy and do things in the way that felt authentic, that I could take a breath and go with my gut and do things my way and not feel like they weren't, that I wasn't following tradition or doing things that someone else thought I should do, and doing things slower and doing things more simply and sort of the way that I grew up.
So the postcard arrives, and is it first in, first serve with the postcard, or is there something about what's written that will secure a place?
I mean, the truth is that we've received so many. Every year we've received over 20,000 postcards. This year we haven't counted yet, but I have a feeling it's far more than that. And it truly is a luck of the draw, because if you saw how many we had, if it makes it to the top of the pile, I mean, that's all just luck. And sure, there are times when we dip in and we close our eyes and we pull out any card that we grab. And sometimes we're human and we see something that catches our eye on the top of the pile. And we receive everything from blank cards to stories that'll make you cry or make you laugh, or pieces of art or quilted postcards. Or we got one the other day that was the face of a sock monkey that someone had clearly taken off of their sock monkey. So we've seen it all, and it just gives us these little snippets of the people who are going to be joining us for dinner and entering our dining room for what we hope is just an intimate and memorable moment that should feel like a dinner with friends. So it's like us getting to know them before they even step foot into our dining room.
I see one here that just says, please pick me, in a smiley face.
Sometimes it's as simple as that.
Yeah. And look, this is the other thing that's difficult to describe, but your challenge is to do it. It's an old grist mill, but goodness, when was this built? And can you please explain the woodwork on the interior, the rafters, just the beauty of what its rebirth is?
Well, this was built back in the 1800s originally. And when I was growing up as a little girl, it was a dilapidated mess. It was crumbling by the side of the river in a place that we were told to avoid because it was so dangerous and only, you know, the bad local boys would hang out here and spray paint and do all the bad boy sort of things. And then the mill got a second chance back about 10 years ago, went through a process of getting on the National Historic Register and being rebuilt from scratch on the same time that I was rebuilding my life. And And now it's standing strong and tall and proud at the center of this community that I call home, and really makes me proud to call this place home.
How many can you seat there?
Well, right now we're still kind of in our COVID transition, so we've been doing about 48, but I think we've maxed out around 52 on a really good night when we could cram people shoulder to shoulder.
And also, is it all women working there? Tell me about the staff and how they've come to work there with you.
We're all women. We do have our tried and true dishwasher, TJ, who is our one male employee here. He puts up with us pretty well. But yeah, there are 14 of us of women. And it really came about in a accidental, organic way, in that I was in a really difficult, challenging time in my life when I was opening this restaurant that seemed like an impossible place in the middle of nowhere. And who would trust a woman in a male-dominated industry to open a restaurant in a town of 700 people and expect it to work? And a woman who was getting out of a devastating divorce and fresh out of rehab. And the people who came to my side were my friends and my girlfriends. And it really started that way. And then we needed more help. And they would reach out to a friend and say, I have this great friend who I think would make a great addition to the team. And it's just built over the years. And there are a good handful of women here who have been with me for 10 years now.
The first events, I think, were they called Secret Suppers?
Yeah, started as a secret supper in my apartment. When I decided that I wanted to really give cooking a go and see if I was any good at it, I didn't have the money to go all out, and I didn't have investors, because who would believe in me with no culinary education and no proof or no real past. And so I did it to really prove it to myself and see if I loved it and see where it took me. And here we are 10 years later, and that Secret Supper Club has become one of the hardest restaurants to get into in probably the world.
Making your way over a footbridge over that river is the final steps into this just quite remarkable building. Let's go back to the beginning, though, because there's food in your family, absolutely, and particularly your dad. And you grew up around a kitchen in the same little town. So tell me of that early experience in and around food and the food business.
Mm-hmm. My father bought his diner back when I was about 5 years old. So just getting into kindergarten, and still have those vivid memories of stepping into that restaurant for the first time. And it was just a greasy spoon, but all the American delights you could dream of, and pancake breakfasts and fried eggs and all of that, and the smell of home fries cooking on the griddle, and just a breakfast, lunch, and dinner sort of fast-paced place. And when you grow up in an environment like that, and your parents are working long hours, 16 and sometimes 18-hour days, that restaurant can become your second living room, and you spend a lot of your life there. And that's what I found, that I was spending all my time after school there, spending all my weekends there. So if I wanted to spend any time with my dad, I better learn how to cook.
And you learn how to work hard. You certainly learned about the long hours, and you know, coming home covered in the whatever accumulates on a cook in a busy kitchen, working around oil and other things. So you learned those hard yards. But a big part of the story is also you love the food. There's no doubt about that. Like many of us, you can recall in great detail some of the most strong memories of childhood around some of this food. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, just, I think that's the power of food, is that it's so much more than something that just nourishes you. It can be just wield these powerful memories of moments. And the food is that vessel to help create and memorialize those moments, even the smells and the tastes, and can bring you right back there. So I definitely was finding that whether I liked it or not, food was just, it was seeping itself into my heart in ways that it was going to be everlasting.
What were the other things you were learning, though, as a little girl in Freedom, Maine, population 719, and some of the hard lessons you were learning? Because what comes through here also is that your father, you wanted to be close to him. It was part of what took you to the restaurant, but he was working hard. He was dealing probably with some of the frustrations of life and the demands of running a business and the relentlessness of it. And and also, you know, you're right, you were meant to be a boy and you were a girl. So, you know, what was some of the hard lessons you learnt early on?
Well, being the daughter to a very difficult father and feeling like you're a constant letdown, and I was starting to believe that relationship was what everyone's relationship was, and it took me really becoming an adult to realize that everyone else didn't grow up that way and feel so deflated all the time and feel like they were, not the best daughter in the world. It's a challenging place growing up in a rural town, and really having quiet reminders all the time of feeling like you had to get the heck out of here to live a better life. And the uncanny thing is, I grew up believing that was the lesson that I was being taught. And the funny thing was, is here I sit here feeling like a very lucky girl to live in this rural place.
So, what happened when you got to your teens? You'd worked in the diner, but these dreams were to go and become a doctor. Was that your dream?
Yeah, oh, my dream was just to get as far away from restaurants or cooking or freedom as possible. And I wanted to go to the city. I wanted to see big bright lights. I grew up on a dirt road on a farm and had never experienced anything like that. And if there's any advice that my mother had really given to me, it was to go and see and experience that and figure out what it is that really makes your heart pound and figure out where you want to live and how you want to live your life. And that was a pivotal moment to feel her support to say, go see it, go do it. And things obviously didn't go the way as planned, but I came back to exactly where I was supposed to be, I think.
What happened when you fell pregnant? I think were you in your third year, and training as a doctor. What happened for you with that? Obviously, shock to your plans, shock to your life. What was its impact?
Well, it was a complete stop down. Everything I had ever imagined my life was going to be was over in a blink. And it felt like I was the biggest failure, that I had a history of letting my father down, and now I've just given him all the ammo in the world to really believe that I was a giant failure. And so I did the only thing that I knew how to do, and that was come back home and go back to the kitchen and start working again, because I had a baby on the way and I had to start making money. I was going to be a single mother. So to save money and live with my parents and work at that diner again and almost kind of hide myself. I'd lost all pride, that I was hiding behind that stove and behind that line to with my own shame and but weirdly, secretly finding all the things I was loving at the same time.
That beautiful little boy of yours is how old now?
Oh gosh, he's going to be 19 in September. So he's a grown-up man now.
Wasn't the end of life's challenges, however, because you did marry, and that marriage was complex and painful, and the divorce particularly so. And how did this wear away at your sense of self, your confidence and your plans for your life?
Everything. I through that marriage, which I just understood when it was happening, I just thought that this was normal. I was raised by a man who was very much like this. I married someone who was very similar, had very similar behavior patterns to my father, because that was what I knew. That's what I understand of relationships to be, of watching my parents, of what I understood men to be. And I didn't know there was a difference. And I completely lost my sense of self in that marriage. Just being dumbed down in the ways that of always questioning yourself and always just feeling completely low. And at the end, didn't know who I was, didn't know what my passions were, didn't know what I loved anymore, what drove me. And I mean, just it came to a crashing point.
Your first husband, though, was involved early on in the business, which just makes things even more complex, right? And you were still with him as the success was building. So, stuff was happening here professionally, but privately things were crumbling.
Right. Yeah. I mean, everything. I was moving forward on a daily basis, and I was really in a position where I was being in a setup situation of where there was nothing that was ever going to be mine. I was never going to have any self anything in that marriage. It wasn't allowed to have any value in that department. So as things were crumbling, I mean, if you have a difficult marriage already, you're already trying to survive that, add in owning a restaurant and trying to work with what I feel has got to be one of the most challenging professions because of the long days, and it's physical and it's mental, it's emotional, and it will tear you down if you're in a good relationship, and you need to be in a strong relationship to get through the challenges of and the demands of that work life. And I was not in a position, so it was just a freight train heading for disaster.
At the lowest of the low is often things have to get. You were using various prescription drugs, yeah, to the point where a stint in rehab was needed. And did you initiate that yourself?
I did, but it was really determined by the one moment I'll never forget of seeing my mother's eyes. And she was seeing me, and I'd been flailing through the night and basically asked her to come and spend the night and sit on my hands because I was afraid that I was going to end my life. And when I saw the look in her eyes after this bleary, just difficult night, it was like a mirror just snapped on. And I saw my mother's pain, and I realized that I was the one that was causing it, and that it was time for me to go, that I needed help, because the pain had sprawled beyond me. And it wasn't just me who was hurting, that I was starting to harm other people with my own pain.
You survived rehab, but often people say the hardest thing about rehab is not just the experience of it, but it's coming out sober and facing up to where life's at. Was it that the case for you?
That was part of the case. I think also the first 48 hours were really the hardest. It was shocking. You went from being able to go where you please and do what you want to being in complete lockdown and being stripped of everything. I mean, you didn't even have basic human rights to use the bathroom by yourself. It became this just smack in the face, shocking reality. And it took time. And within the first week, I was softening into it. And within week two, I could feel the power and the change and the possibilities that could be made. Things were cut short because of my insurance, and it did make coming home a little more difficult because there wasn't a transition plan in place. It was just like, okay, you're going back home, but now you're going back home. And while you were away, you lost your son, you lost your home, you lost your business. All the doors and the locks have been changed, and every possession inside, including the kid that you love more than anything, everything is gone. So it was going there and leaving there that were the two hardest things.
It is shocking, and I've just got to say, an indictment on the way the American health system works. Ours is far from perfect, trust me, and there's many, many people in queues here waiting for treatment they need. But when your insurance ran out, they just said, sorry, you're going home tomorrow in the middle of rehab. It's just mind-blowing.
She got on the street, and you couldn't, like I said, you couldn't even have a private pee 12 hours before, and now you're just, they're kicking you to the airport and saying good luck.
This is where we move into what is called the cabin mobile, wasn't it? We're back home to the parents' place, living in a cabin, and as you say, you've got all this stuff, you've got debt, you've got the custody battle, all of it going on. And you know, how soon after that did moving back to freedom, did things begin to turn for you and life begin to reconstruct itself, I guess, or you reconstruct it?
Yeah, I mean, everything was swirling around me like this giant storm. It's just, you know, I was coming home, and if I was in normal circumstances in a good position, I would have been focusing on getting better, but I had to expedite getting better, and I had to stand up and just like put my strong boots on and face a war that was coming down on me between the custody battle and the losing of my business and trying to break myself free of this toxic relationship and move forward with this divorce. And so I went to a place, and I've felt it a few times. I even felt it recently going through COVID of where you go to this point of survival, and this amazing thing that happens as a human is this is adrenaline. And it happens when you find yourself in a corner and you find yourself trying to survive, that this amazing amount of strength will come out of you that can only happen when you're in those moments. And it's, I believe it's human and designed to help us push through these crazy moments, because I look back on that strength and I'm like, God, girl, how did you do that? But I feel it when I have those moments. This past 2 years ago, when I thought I was going to lose my restaurant again, when everything shut down, it's like I felt it again. And I never stopped going. I never stopped moving. I knew that if I curled up in a ball and I laid down and I started to cry, that I would never get up again. And so I just didn't stop.
When did it go crazy, almost in a Hollywood way? And I'm not taking away from all the work that went into it, but now to be in this situation where thousands of people write to you from all over the world, I know that's the way you've set it up, but it happens. You're constantly oversubscribed. The local post office must be thriving. Not many are anymore, but yours is. And, you know, what was it that took this tiny town's restaurant to what it is now? Was there a particular impetus?
There really wasn't a pow moment. It wasn't like overnight something exploded, but it was like a very fast moving vehicle that was heading higher and higher and was not stopping. I opened 7 years ago here, and we were booked the first day, and it was insane how I couldn't imagine that people were going to travel all this way for dinner. I really got surprised, and I really had to shift the business as I started. I started just thinking it was going to be a sleepy cafe, and I wasn't thinking about doing dinner. I was just going to have English muffins and Wi-Fi and good coffee. And I was astounded to find out that the people who had been loving my food for my first restaurant were willing to travel the distance to come out to this little town and be here. And it really just empowered me to see those familiar faces and to keep moving and realize that my food had touched them, and I could keep doing that and I could keep building upon it, but this time in a healthier way, being free of a toxic relationship and starting to hone and take back my belief in myself and find my self-worth again. And it, every year it just kept getting bigger and it kept getting bigger. And I will never forget that night when I came in and the phones exploded when we opened them at midnight on the 1st of April, and it didn't stop ringing. And we got over 10,000 phone calls within a span of what must have been 24 hours. It was insane.
We've learned about the viral effect in a negative way this past year or two, but it can happen in a positive way as word of mouth spread things. There is something special. There is clearly your food. You're not a trained chef, but you've been working in kitchens since you were a primary school kid, and clearly the menu and the food is a big part of this. It is an astonishingly beautiful building, looking at it from a distance. And then there's some other kind of X factor. What do you believe that X factor is that makes people travel so far to walk over that bridge and spend a night at yours?
I've been pondering that since we opened this place on day one. And it took me a few years to figure out what it was, because it felt like there was this bit of magic that was happening, and it was invisible. And I think over the years, what I've realized is that it was really the love that we were putting into this place. And it wasn't just me. I was coming here and I was putting all of my heart out, but it was also the other women on my team who are coming and putting just as much love. They cared about this place as much as I did. They were coming from their farms and they were bringing flowers and tomatoes and whatever they could bring for produce, so that they had something that they were invested in, and they were getting to watch the joy, the same joy that I would get when people would watch, when I would get to watch them enjoy one of my dishes. They would get that when they would watch that customer eat the tomato that they grew from seed, or, you know, just ogle over the beautiful flower arrangements that we had made with the flowers that my friend Ashley had grown. And I think because we made people feel comfortable, and it was a fancy restaurant, but it was never a pretentious or a stuffy place. It was a place that you could put your elbows on the table and you could feel like you were at home. And we just made people feel truly loved when they sat here, like they were a part of our family or good friends.
The question now is where you go with this. You're married again, which is wonderful, and your boys, you know, grown. You've got the TV series now. I think you've just finally launched a website. So you're on the cusp, aren't you, of facing that question again of what is finding freedom?
Yeah. Well, that question has been asked a lot, and people will ask me, well, what's next? And I keep thinking, like, does what has to be next? Why? I'm really in protection mode right now and just trying to savor every moment of what we've built, and as part of the reason of trying to slow things down here, because I know the magic of this place is how small and intimate it is. And it's not about growing it to be bigger and to make franchises and have airport kiosks and do all the things that have come our way that sure would be maybe the smarter business move, but maybe the smarter life move was just to be satisfied and proud of that little beautiful thing that you created and keeping it going for as long as you possibly can and loving every day that you show up to work. And that for me, that's kind of my goal right now.
Erin, thank you. I might get a postcard in the mail for, I don't know, when we're allowed out of here again.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. Erin French, Finding Freedom in the Lost Kitchen is her memoir. You can see a video if you want to see, I'm describing how beautiful the old grist mill is, 19th century. If you want to see how they've converted it and what it all looks like, there's a video on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9to9.